Welcome, readers, to the Read Podcast, where we connect you with researchers, thought leaders, and educators on topics in education and child development. I'm Danielle Scarano, and I am eager to introduce our third Lead on Read episode. Lead on Read is co-hosted by me and Jamie Williamson, the Wynwood School's head of school and the Wynwood Institute's executive director. This four-part series highlights leaders who are disrupting the status quo and creating change in reading education. In this episode, Jamie and I invited Dr. Katie Pace Miles to record live with us at Wynwood's New York City campus. You can watch our conversation at the Wynwood Institute's YouTube channel, where you can access all of our Lead on Read conversations. Dr. Miles was on episode 37 of the Read podcast. She completed her doctorate in education psychology and learning development and instruction with a subspecialization in research on the acquisition of literacy with Dr. Linnea Airy in her tenure track faculty line at Brooklyn College. Dr. Miles now oversees the graduate and undergraduate development and teaching of literacy courses in the early childhood department. Dr. Miles was also an early childhood and childhood teacher and learning specialist, where she conducted reading and writing assessments of and interventions with students with literacy delays and disabilities. Dr. Miles now works closely with teachers, families, and school psychologists to support student progress. In this episode, Jamie, Dr. Miles, and I dive into her leadership work at CUNY Reading Corps. We discuss how she's working to change the landscape in reading education for pre-service teachers, and she offers her insights on what it means to be a leader in education right now. After you listen to this episode, I hope you are just as energized and inspired by Dr. Miles' work and insights as we were. Be sure to check out the Lead on Read bookmarks after the episode at readpodcast.org. Enjoy the episode, readers.
Hello, hello. Good morning.
Nice to see you both. Thank
you. See you as well.
Jamie, how are you approaching this conversation? How are you today? Before we really introduce Dr. Miles,
yeah,
how are you feeling?
Well, it was a beautiful weekend. I got to spend some time out on the bike, kind of clearing the head a little bit. It's a gorgeous day today after what was a terrible weather week last week. So I'm just really happy to be here. Really happy to, you know, actually finally meet you in person. We were just chatting earlier about the fact we've been on a ton of Zooms together, but have never actually been in the same room. So this is kind of a nice little treat. So I'm just really excited to have the conversation today. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, absolute pleasure. I'm so happy to be here.
How are you doing? Before I introduce all of your amazing accolades, I'd like to know how you're doing this morning.
I'm good. I got my kiddos off to school. I'm right after this, I'm heading to San Francisco for two talks that I'm going to give. And so I'm feeling energized and grateful that people are interested in the work.
That's great. For our readers out there, so those that are watching this won't get your full bio, but those that are listening will get the full formal bio. But I wanted to read a few pieces of who you are and how you're coming to this conversation. So associate professor at Brooklyn College, CUNY. The co-founder and PI of CUNY Reading Corps, which we're so excited to talk about, which pairs pre-service teacher training and provides free high dosage tutoring for those in historically underserved communities.
Right.
You're a literacy researcher. We spoke on episode 37 about your work on orthographic mapping and early literacy. And as you know, actually, I don't think you know this. It's our most popular episode. So people loved it. Yes.
Local celebrity.
Oh, yes. You are the advisor of Reading Rescue. And then you also created the Reading Ready program, which is explicit and systematic word reading for kindergartens and first grade. So all these amazing things. We're so excited to have you. But we really want to focus more on your leadership story. So as you think about your career and your work as a leader, what called you to lead? And can you tell us more about that?
Sure. It was really, it had everything to do with the exacerbated inequities during the pandemic. That's really where I think I found the moment where I saw a grave need. I live in Brooklyn and it was all around me. I have two young children in Brooklyn and I would be on Zoom calls. I'm a professor, as you just mentioned. So I'd be on Zoom calls with all of my CUNY students. They have children around Brooklyn. They're teaching around the borough. And I knew about the inequities because I would be in and out of schools prior to the pandemic. Once it hit, I would hear about all of the exacerbated pieces and elements, and it wasn't getting any better. And my students would tell me about the lack of services their own children, nieces and nephews, were receiving. And they would tell me about, as a teacher, how they felt so ill-equipped to provide the amount of interventions that their early readers needed. And so it was really birthed out of that. And I had a network that I could leverage. And so I did in that moment.
Yeah.
Wow.
Standing.
I'm curious, as you think back to the pandemic in the last few years, there's been so much that our leaders have reflected on. I mean, Jamie and I have spoken at length about some of the things that he's reflected on as a leader. And so I'm curious, what does it mean to be a leader for you right now?
I appreciate how you contextualize that in the right now.
Right.
I really think it has to do for me right now around empathy. Mm-hmm. And when I started CUNY Reading Corps, it had a lot to do with empathy. I set ambitious goals. I tried to do something to support the community. And really at every step along the journey, I was humbled by how much empathy I needed to bring to the table mm-hmm. for the tutors who we were asking to do this work at a really difficult time in their lives, for the children who were really struggling, not just academically, but social emotionally, the teachers in the schools that we were reaching out to. We never could claim that like, oh, we're here to solve all the problems. We weren't. We do we provide a service. Mm-hmm. And they're really the ones in there all day, every day. They were battling the pandemic with these kiddos. Mm-hmm. So also just empathy for each other. Those of us on the CUNY Reading Corps team, we needed to have a lot of grace with each other to get this off the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. You know, I want to sort of touch on a few things you said a little bit, this idea of empathy. Schools are microcosms of like a greater society, right? Mm-hmm. And right now we're having all these debates about debt ceiling, all this stuff happening. I think we need to raise the empathy ceiling a little bit, because I completely agree with you. The work that's happening right now and the stress of the last few years has been absolutely incredible. And I think educators and medical professionals have been, you know, really put upon. And I think that we do have to come to the table with a lot of grace for each other, a lot of empathy, a lot of compassion, trying to kind of make sure we're trying to understand someone's perspective, and maybe even a little more curiosity than we normally sort of show up with in a given conversation.
Yes.
But I love this idea of aligning passion and purpose. And one of the things that if you ever happen to be around for our middle school graduation, you're welcome. You're always invited.
We'd
love to have
that.
You. But I do a little graduation speech for our eighth graders heading off. But I talk about this idea of purpose sometimes and passion. And I think so often in this kind of, you know, me-centric society that we have sort of somehow evolved into, it's all about sort of this internal reflective, you know, me.
Yeah.
I think we forget sometimes that actually passion is not an internal sort of exploration.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big believer in this concept. I think passion is actually an external expression, right? You're looking at the world, you're seeing need in the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then it's sort of like you have this kind of compulsion almost to fill that need, mm-hmm. right? And so when I think about the work that you've been doing here, and when recognizing the incredible inequities that exist across the spectrum in education.
Mm-hmm.
New York City is really, to say that it's like, you know, one of the deepest and most sort of, you know, illustrative kind of, you know, spaces of that concept would be a wild understatement, right?
Mm-hmm.
The inequities in the city are absolutely stunning sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it exists across the country. You mm-hmm. know, even in Ohio where I was, you see these wealthy suburbs and these inner city schools. The amount of resource available to them wildly different. So tell us a little bit about how you work to align this sense of purpose and passion and sort of, you know, finding this space in the work that you're doing currently.
Well, it's really, I appreciate this passion piece too. I do like, when I talk about literacy, I'm just really lucky I wound up in the career that I wound up in. I don't mean to take us back to like the start, but
no.
I was going to go into a different field.
Mm-hmm.
I found my way into education, and it was really because it just brought out such joy in me every mm-hmm. time I was able to do it.
Yeah.
And I wanted to learn more and keep going. And during the pandemic, we all kind of, I think, lost that, or at least I did. I lost this sense of joy. I'm an academic, and so you're supposed to be doing a lot of research.
Yeah.
I was pre-tenure even in the midst of the pandemic too. So I should have been just totally focused mm-hmm. on my own research publications. So that the old saying, you know, publish or perish.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't do it anymore. I was like, no, actually, wait a second. I'm looking at all of this need. I know that this is just the scratching of the surface of the amount of need out there. And why don't I just go for reach instead mm-hmm. of research? And so one of the things that I really, needed to pause on in this like me society was it would have benefited me mm-hmm. academically if I would have started off with a research project.
Yeah.
Right.
And instead I started off with just trying to meet the needs of mm-hmm. university students and children. and I totally put that aside.
Yeah.
And I found so much passion. I felt like I found my passion, my joy.
Yeah.
Every reason I went into education came back to me in the midst of this really awful time, of course. Mm-hmm. And so that has really been just the driving force to continue it. It started as a COVID response initiative mm-hmm. that I did not plan to continue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's scaled tremendously.
Yeah.
And so I think it's because it's not just about me. Everyone who's come to work at CUNY Reading Corps, I think has found the same purpose, joy, whatever it is in the work.
Yeah.
So.
Can I ask one question? There's
like
a nugget
so
in here
excited.
That I'm like
yeah.
dying to know more about. So you talked about this not being your kind of initial career sort of thought.
Yes.
So what did you want to do before you went into educational psychology and the reading work you're doing?
I was going to be a lawyer.
Wow.
Yes.
So that outstanding.
Yes.
You know, I love how people find their space. You know, I was a psychology major and undergraduate. I wanted to be a researcher. I wanted to go to graduate school. Worked in a cognitive laboratory. Looking at older adults and frontal lobe functioning, looked at one on visual discrimination in older adults,
sure.
and frontal lobe functioning, executive functioning kind of components. Yeah. And I was like, I want to do research. So I went to work for the FDA, a study at the Veterans Hospital looking at crack cocaine addiction. It was like a medication trial for the FDA.
Sure.
And I got there and I was like, love working with the patients. Not where I want to be.
There it is.
I was collecting study measures. I was doing lit review work. I loved that side of it.
Yeah.
But I saw the PI of the study who never left her office.
Yeah, it's
like
really...
from 7 to like 7 at night,
yep.
you know, eat salad at her desk. And I was like, ooh, that's not the life I want to lead here. And then I found myself in a school and angry about services kids were getting. And
that's right.
And it sort of kind of kept developing from there.
Yep.
But I love how, you know, there's so few kind of linear sort of paths in this world, right?
Yes.
It's often a nice little zigzag of opportunity and openness and sort of, you know, kind of further deepening that kind of passion and exploration. So thank you for that.
Of course.
I want to echo that too. I think since I started the Read podcast, and I actually started Read when I was teaching. I think we had talked about that mm-hmm. in our last episode. And I had started it when I was starting my doctorate program.
Mm-hmm.
And I just finished actually. So I'm graduating in a few weeks.
Oh, congratulations.
Yes, exactly.
Big round of applause.
Wonderful. One of the things that was so inspiring to me is I read this one paper actually, Badalataleka Boxenbaum, 2009. And I like to say, because it's a fun authors, but they talk about this idea of institutional entrepreneurship in education and bridging. And one of the things that I connected to that was more about this idea of social entrepreneurship in education and what that looks like. Because, you know, as both what I hear you both saying is that in education, sometimes, especially in higher ed, you hear of people doing the traditional research path. And I don't know if our readers have noticed or if you two have seen, but I start to gravitate to those researchers and leaders that are pushing the envelope, are building into the social entrepreneurship and disrupting this educational status quo. And that's what Badalana et al. 2009 said was really disrupting the educational status quo. And when we spoke on episode 39 about the CUNY Reading Corps, you said that you wanted to disrupt the pre-existing notion about university fieldwork.
Yeah.
And so I know you've talked a little bit about how it started,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, talk us a little bit more about why the tutoring, and specifically in your work as a researcher and then trying to maximize impact, why high dosage tutoring? Can you walk us through that a little bit more?
Sure. Oh, so the fieldwork piece, I'll start there. The fieldwork piece is critical because as anyone who's been trained as a teacher will remember that at some point in multiple courses that you were taking, you had to go into a school and do mm-hmm. something. And that's called your fieldwork. It was affiliated with a course. It may have been that you were observing a student. It may have been that you were doing a read aloud or something mm-hmm. like that. That time is precious.
Mm-hmm.
There's only so many courses that have the accompanying field work. And in early literacy, we only have one course where university students are trained in how to teach a child how to read.
Mm-hmm.
And so the 30 hours of field work that are affiliated with the courses I teach or oversee in the early childhood department at Brooklyn College are critical.
Yeah.
And so could you imagine you only get 15 weeks? And one of those weeks has to be, we're going to go over the syllabus. And, you know, one of those mm-hmm. weeks is going to be the final project.
Mm-hmm.
So you're down to 13 weeks on how to teach a child how to read. from pre-K to second grade.
And only about 3 hours a week, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Only about 3 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
So that field work has to be maximized.
Yeah.
And prior to the pandemic, I tried all different sorts of things. And it was in the pandemic when I just said, okay, I've been researching tutoring, mm-hmm. high dosage tutoring, high dosage meaning that it's 3 to 5 days a week mm-hmm. and it's the same tutor with the same child and they're doing using some kind of high quality evidence-based program.
Right.
And I've been researching this. I know that it works. Why shouldn't this be what we give the children from communities that need it the most? I also know that this is what children from families who have means, this is what they get.
Mm-hmm.
They oftentimes will get a minimum of two,
yeah.
if not an additional like Zoom session or something like that, or they have a parent who can step in and provide that additional support.
Mm-hmm.
And it's happening all around us. And I don't disparage it wherever it's occurring. It's what kids need. And
yeah.
it doesn't matter if you're a child from this family or that family. We just have to make sure all children can get it.
Right.
And so that's really what I wanted to do. I wanted to disrupt the field work and say, you know what? We're going to all come together. I'm going to train you. You're going to actually provide this service, but it's not just about the child. It's also about you as the pre-service teacher feeling like you can make a difference like this, that you're really well equipped to do explicit, systematic, multimodal instruction, not just talk about it in class.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone could talk about it in
yeah.
class.
Yeah.
It's a whole other thing
yeah.
to execute a program and then execute it over 20 sessions.
Right.
With fidelity and
with
integrity.
Fidelity, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
And look at the data
yeah.
to
mm-hmm.
see if you're, you know, do you have to modify things along the way?
Yeah. Outstanding.
Cool.
So one, I love this. You know, I'm as a school psychologist, I spent years, you know, working in schools, evaluating kids, trying to kind of push into some of the public schools that I worked at, bringing this idea of data, looking at some programmatic pieces. And I worked at a middle school and you see, I would have kids come in sixth grade, third grade reading level, 3 years
yep.
later. Third grade reading level, like no impact. And having now interviewed teachers for the better part of 15, 16 years in my sort of leadership journey, I have always been so surprised at how little actual work teachers get in pre-service stuff. So where I want to come back to that, because I'm so like excited about what you're doing. I also love the idea of building on some other ideas and like try to find ways to kind of connect things. But so when you look at this, the CUNY Reading Corps here, I'm thinking like Peace Corps model, right?
Yeah.
You drop in, you do something really intense for the good of the world, right? And I feel like that's what you're doing, this idea of training these 900 tutors. And would you be able to reach 2,300 early readers in the DOE process now, which is absolutely incredible. So I just want to just acknowledge that and just say, like, I think that's just really such an accomplishment here. So when you think about this idea of being the disruptor, reinventing the whole the practicum model there, or the classroom or the field placement model there,
mm-hmm.
talk to me about how you gained support, because I would imagine mm-hmm. at the university level, you know, things are done a certain way, right? There's tradition, which is great,
yes,
but also tradition can be one of the things that stands in our way to actually do the work that needs to be done over the moment.
Yes.
So how did you build some support within CUNY for that sort of approach?
So I have a tremendously supportive chair of my department. And as an academic, that makes a big difference.
Right. Yeah, uh-huh.
The chair of my department is Dr. Jacqueline Shannon. Mm-hmm. She has done a lot of early interventions work around New York City in underserved communities.
Okay.
So while she's not a literacy person, she understands, and our work is parallel in that
yeah.
way. She understands the need for service and the translation of research into practice.
Mm-hmm.
So I had immediate support from her. And another chair of a department could have said, no, Katie, you need to focus just on publishing.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
you need to work on course development
mm-hmm.
or service to the college or something like that. She really saw that this was my service to the college, that this was yeah. my course development, and that eventually this would generate research, which is where we are now 3 years later with CUNY Reading Corps.
Yeah.
And so that was key. And then she helped advocate for me with the dean of the School of Education, who then helped advocate for me with the university dean of education, a university dean, Ashley Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
And that there was a critical point. I started this in the fall of 2020 in mm-hmm. the depths of the pandemic. And by the spring of 2021, these wonderful people at CUNY that I had just mentioned really saw the potential of this and they saw it growing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they maybe saw me working tirelessly on
yeah.
this. And they said, you know, we should really give some services and support to this. They started to see the vision,
right?
As well, and wanted to share in it. And University Dean Thompson took the initiative into her office, which has been such a gift.
Wow.
It's been incredible. So, you know, I'm there's 25 CUNY campuses.
Yeah.
And I'm one. I'm at Brooklyn College. That's where this started.
Yeah.
When we moved this into the CUNY Central at University Dean Thompson's office, she was able to hire Dr. Aaron Croak, who could oversee the operations. You know, we might talk about HR and, you know, things like that. You know, I'm a content specialist and a researcher.
Yeah.
And I really needed support on implementation and all of those different types of things. That level of support really allowed this to scale.
Yeah.
And I was bringing on grad students of mine who had been in the course in fall of 2020 or spring of 2021. And I was promoting them into what we may talk about later, a lead instructor role or a program manager. And I was just trying to build this from the bottom up.
Yeah.
And we really needed someone who had expertise, you know, at an operations level.
Yeah.
It just grew so quickly.
Yeah.
And so anyway, all of that support was because the university saw the potential. They saw that this was transformative for the system.
Right.
Was because we were then, when it moved to Central, we could recruit pre-service teachers, not just from Brooklyn College.
Mm-hmm.
We could recruit from all campuses.
That's outstanding.
And now we have CUNY Reading Core tutors from 18 different campuses.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's really, and we have, I get so excited about this. I'm sorry.
No, please.
We have three other campuses who are now embedding this in their coursework.
Right.
So it's one thing where you embed it in your coursework, and we need more professors around CUNY who want to do this as part of their fieldwork.
Yeah.
And then we also hire pre-service teachers. Those are two different tracks where as a tutor, you could wind up in CUNY Reading Core.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So as you're talking, one of my other interests is thinking about scalability, sustainability, implementation, and de-implementation. And there's so many things that I think I'm hearing from you, and I'm kind of connecting when you said, you know, recruiting the central office. I'm like, oh, that might have helped with cost and grants.
Mm-hmm.
And when recruiting someone with expertise in operations, oh, that helped with human resources and human capacity.
Mm-hmm.
From your perspective and your vision, I know you talked about hiring expert tutors and instructors and things like that. What were those mechanisms? Tell us maybe a little bit more explicitly about the mechanisms to achieving the scalability and ensuring the sustainability of this program.
The mechanism. So I think it started first with being able to demonstrate that we could do this with quality, with fidelity, within a contained situation at CUNY, which is the embedded, we call it the embedded course model, which just means it's part of your classes.
Right.
I think that establishing that first and not trying to do two things at once, I could have come into this and said, oh, I'm going to get grant money and hire tutors. Instead, I said, let me try and get grant money so that I can just do this within my courses, where I do have a lot of academic oversight, right? And starting there was key because I was able to leverage a critical player in all of this is my close colleague, Andrew Fletcher, at the Department of Education. He was one of my first phone calls when I was applying for the grant from Heckscher Foundation and the Benedict Silverman Foundation. I said, if I was to receive this grant money to train all of the students that I teach or oversee in these courses, I'll get them ready to go. I'll oversee them. Could you help us get into the schools? You have to remember, everything was shut down.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't go anywhere. We had to Zoom in. We didn't even Zoom into the house. I'm sorry. We didn't even Zoom into schools. We Zoomed into households.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
was so intimate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I needed someone like Andrew to help with all of that HR, all of the legal pieces of this on the Department of Ed side.
Right.
I was trying to deal with it on the CUNY side. And once we had a proof of concept, that's what we were able to bring to like CUNY Central and whatnot and to say, look, this is, you can actually do this to all of our great surprise.
Yeah.
Not only can you do it, it works. We had evidence that the students were improving.
How do you maintain that coherence though, right? So you are spreading it to other CUNY schools, and someone from the outside, I would assume that every CUNY instructor doing this fully endorses and has experience in structured literacy programs, right? So that's my question, is how do you ensure coherence with that program? Is it something that you're working on? Is it something that you've learned or you've had to navigate?
Yes, I've worked on it a lot. Oh, great point that you just made. The assumption that everyone has had some sort of structured literacy coursework, and they haven't.
Okay.
So I think one of the things that gets me so excited about this is knowing that, you know, our goal this year is 800 CUNY pre-service teachers and an additional set of DOE staff members who are going to be trained. That's how we get to the 900.
Yeah.
It's my way of maybe getting in the back door a little bit and saying, like, maybe you haven't had coursework on this, but CUNY Reading Corps could provide you with it. One program has 6 hours of high quality asynchronous training and the other program has 12 hours. And it's very, I will, because I've been able to develop the programs, either myself or over time with colleagues, we know what's in those PDs. We ask questions about structured literacy.
Yeah.
And afterwards, we have all of the tutors practice before we even launch them into a pairing.
Yeah.
And that's all the CUNY Reading Corps' expertise. Great. They're amazing at doing this. And that's how we know, at a minimum, we've reached this many individuals who next year and the year to come are going to go off into the DOE. And they will have had this training. And I like to think of it a little bit as like an inoculation.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like they got their shot and maybe they're not going to be, you know, succumb to some other types of literacy practices that we know don't work.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Don't you just want to go in the streets of Manhattan and just like shout?
Yeah, I kind
of
do.
You know, just out of so excited and excited.
So yeah, I'm thinking about so many, I have so many questions right now. One is I'm thinking about this kind of uphill push that you started, which was really against your own sort of economic incentive, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I want to kind of call it. So I'm getting to kind of calling out the university incentive on how they kind of, you know, the idea of like, it's all about publishing, right?
Right.
And, you know, and sometimes we've talked to a number of researchers that we try to partner with this idea of translational science and no one wants to fund translational science work.
Right.
They're all about funding based science or a really interesting sort of, you know, research component. But when it comes to bringing that in, there's really not a lot of incentives to help bridge that gap. Yeah. And I think within the university, if it's all about publish or perish, then the incentive to pursue a non-publishing track here is pretty daunting. So I just want to applaud you for the courage there.
That.
And I think we need more folks in academia who sort of see that purpose and push in that direction. Because I think we have to change the incentive model at the university level, right? And I think about even for us and school districts and teacher training, like I think we have to have a massive rethinking of how all these things come together and how all the pieces fit together. So,
Absolutely.
And I think your model actually has a lot of utility in that sort of conversation, if I could be really honest about that.
Thank you.
I think it's just really important. I also, you know, when we think about, you know, because we have a teacher training program here that we do. So I've been interviewing teachers for a long time.
Yes.
I have yet to meet someone who walks in our door ready to teach in a program like this, right? Because we have to do so much unlearning to unlearn all the programs that they give, they've had out there, or the bad information that folks get about what's right and what the research says, or, well, I read this article and they have no idea where the article came from, right?
Yes.
It was someone's opinion at a party that they were chatting with.
Yes.
But how do we move the whole system in some way that allows us to start to shift the conversation away from this kind of, you know, almost really myopic sense of how we train teachers in just the theoretical side of this, to bring in more application side and allow that bridge to get a little bit stronger from that research to that translational kind of component there. Any thoughts about how others who are in your position working in a pre-service teacher training program might be able to kind of push back against that system a little bit?
I would just, thanks for really pulling this part out. I really want to encourage any academic to consider what their translational piece is and how they can really give that gift to their university students.
Yeah.
My university students have been so emphatically appreciative of this opportunity. Even in the really difficult times of doing this, they, at the end of the semester, they would say, "I can't believe we did that. That was awesome.
Yeah.
That was just unbelievable that you gave us that experience." And so I hope that maybe is enthusing some other academics. I'll also call out that as academics who are doing this type of work, it's really on us to do as much dissemination about it. I know that there's a lot of other academics who are trying different formats of this in other subject areas. And I think through dissemination, you get more buy-in.
Yeah.
And so with my work through the Benedict Silverman Foundation, CUNY Reading Corps has been replicated, and I believe it's in now 15 universities across the country. And there are like 3 to 5 more universities that are considering coming on board and doing some aspect yeah. of CUNY Reading Corps, even if they're just going to do one of the programs, mm-hmm. even if it's a professor that has one course, 20 students, I'm so excited when yeah. that person reaches yeah. out after I give a talk or something. You know, she'll say, I've always wanted to do this with my students, but I couldn't get a grant. And we'll say, do it. Yeah. Like, here's a program, go for it.
Yeah.
And then I think that's how we change the university mm-hmm. system is incrementally we get more and more professors.
Yeah.
A little bit, being insubordinate in a way and saying like, no, I'm not going to do
disruptors.
Exactly. Well,
was it John Lewis, kind of the good trouble,
yeah,
right?
Good trouble. You know? Very, very good trouble.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes. I like that. I like yes. that a lot.
And then the university system will come around too, because when grant money starts coming in to fund yeah. these things, I just want to call yep. it out. Like, we've mm-hmm. had incredible funders
right.
who did come. They saw the vision. They came with generosity of spirit.
Yeah.
And they didn't know me from anyone.
Right.
And they just had trust. And they said, okay, let's go for it. The universities also, they need and want that grant money. Mm-hmm. I'm not criticizing it. I'm saying that's also the way the system works.
Right.
And so that really helps universities when grant money and relationships with funders are strengthened through these types of partnerships.
Yeah. You know, we run a school here. We recruit about 35 to 45 teachers a year to go through our training program and kind of build up our teacher base here. You know, I've talked to a lot of colleagues around the country who run schools. Finding teachers these days is getting harder. It seems to be getting harder. So I'm hoping you have a ray of sunshine for us from the university side of this.
Oh my gosh.
Because it's, you know, like, are we getting at the university level people who are interested in education? Are we finding people who kind of persist through? You know, I think one of the things that's always been fascinating is some of the data around teacher persistence when they first get out of undergraduate or graduate school to kind of come and teach. Like, the stats on the first 5 years have been pretty grim.
Right.
And so from your vantage point, like, what are the positives of the state of teacher training, and what are the things we should be really thinking about or worried about as we move forward here?
Okay, very good. So I'm very positive about teacher training. Our department, the early childhood department at Brooklyn College, our enrollment is up.
Okay.
Whereas all other universities, it seems like in teacher ed, are down. Programs are down. They're really bleeding. They need more support. Our program is up. There's an enthusiasm, I think, definitely around early childhood mm-hmm. and the need to provide high quality instruction right from the start.
Right.
So I'm very positive about that. I'm very positive about the creative advanced certificates that are available in the education space now. And I think that that's really energizing pre-service teachers or in-service teachers.
Right.
And so I encourage universities to keep going with there's all different kinds of coursework that people can explore. I will say one thing that my next frontier is about getting scholarships for mm-hmm. in-service teachers and prior to going out there.
Yeah.
I think if we want to attract more people into the field, we know the obvious things,
right?
Pay teachers more, treat them better, all of these different things. I think one really obvious thing that we don't ever talk about, though, is like, why don't we pay for people to go and get an education degree?
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's so.
I've been screaming this one for a while.
Oh, there we go. I'm sorry.
No, I completely agree. Part of me, because I'm trying to kind of crack that nut in some ways, mm-hmm. it's a really challenging problem. I think if you're going to go into education, you shouldn't have to pay for your undergraduate.
I agree completely.
And maybe if there's some caveat, as long as you work 5 years, 10 years, whatever the thing is. But, you know, I almost think to navigate that and also have a high quality experience for folks. Like, are we at a point where we're looking at kind of almost the old state model of teacher colleges, where we have almost like a Votech sort of school, but we have a full on teacher's college, not the other one.
Right.
Across the park.
Yes.
But a college that focuses on the good research and really actually preparing pre-service teachers, and have that be completely free for folks who are going into education.
Yes.
Because I get a little bit upset sometimes when I hear about the load of people's debts when they come out of undergraduate with a teaching degree.
Yes. Yes.
When you think about the starting salary of a teacher.
Yes.
Like, this person's going to be broke forever.
That's right.
Right? There's just way to dig out of a hole of $150,000 in debt and making $50,000 a year.
That's right.
And so I think that we need to rethink some of those pathways for folks. And I love, because the research actually on alternative pathways to certification is actually really good.
Yep.
Yeah.
That there's some other ways to get folks to that spot. And the quality of the educator actually doesn't change dramatically.
Oh, no. Yes.
So.
But one of the things I reached out to, in addition to the grant work that we do with CUNY Reading Corps, I reached out to some funders and I said, if I opened a new course, would mm-hmm. you fund scholarships for this? And again, I just wanted to start
yeah.
in a very small micro way. And they without hesitation, they said, yes, because we're in this teacher shortage. How else are we going to solve this?
Yeah.
I said, great. So, you know, there went another grant and all of the students in a new course that I opened in last fall. And then I ran it again this spring. They all received, if they passed the course with a B or higher and completed their tutoring, which is their fieldwork, they received a scholarship to pay for that course.
Wow.
That's outstanding.
So it was like my reverse way to do it. I just really want to make sure I'm like, you know, walking the talk of what I'm saying. I really do believe in that. The other thing I want to say is, assist, you wanted me to highlight a couple of really positive notes too. A system like CUNY is just incredible with regards to training pre-service teachers because we have about 76% of our students in pre-service training are persons of color.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so CUNY Reading Corps, I believe, or maybe I'm giving you the percentage of our tutors who are students of color in CUNY Reading Corps.
Yeah.
I mean, it's remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
So at the same time we're talking about teacher shortage, we've also, for decades, we have been talking about the need to diversify the teacher pool.
Right.
Right. And so you have to find the right university to do this type of work. And I just feel really lucky I landed at CUNY.
Yeah.
It got it all. And so these CUNY tutors, people sometimes say like, how did it get off the ground with CUNY Reading Corps? And I was like, well, I actually think it has a lot to do with the special sauce of the CUNY students and the CUNY tutors.
Yeah.
They are individuals who overwhelmingly went to the New York City public schools.
Right.
They're now trying to become a teacher to give back to their communities.
Yeah.
And in the midst of the pandemic, this was also whereas I felt like this was like, this is what we need to do. The tutors were so aligned.
Yeah.
They were just like, this is absolutely what we need to do. They did not feel like this was burdensome.
Mm-hmm.
This was more coursework or anything like that. They really felt the calling to do this.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a job. Like, even the tutors who we hire, they don't come to it as if it's a job. I do.
Yeah.
They feel like it's an academic opportunity and it's meaningful work.
Yeah.
Right.
So I guess that part is a job, but when it's meaningful, it feels different than a regular old job.
I would agree. I would agree.
That brings it back to your passion versus purpose.
Yes.
You know, and I'm even thinking about I did my school psychology training at Miami University in Ohio, in Oxford, Ohio, and the state of Ohio had a real school psych shortage for quite some, I think they still do. So they had developed this whole entire sort of internship process where a lot of universities got funding for graduate students to kind of go through the program. And there was all this incentive to make sure they were bringing out high quality school psychologists, but also in a quick and timely manner. And I had a state paid internship through the state where I got to shadow and spend a year being a school psychologist alongside of my mentor. But actually doing some really great work. And I just think there's so many models to explore ways to get folks out of either undergraduate or graduate school without taking out a lot of debt around some
Absolutely.
Of these things and create a nice little foundation for us to grow on. But I also have to applaud CUNY on this sort of diversity side of this because
amazing.
I've had so many conversations with other folks who teach at other, I don't want to pick on any of the big 10 schools that I'm talking about specifically. But some friends who teach in those programs and who, when I ask the question, how many students of color do you have in your foundations class? Like literally had to spend some time thinking about like, oh my gosh, I'm not sure we hit maybe one out of like 100. Like the percentage of kids going in some of these universities is so low.
Oh, it's so low.
And so, and I think that we need, again, across the country to find ways to bring more diversity, both racial and I would say gender diversity into the conversation.
Well, even on that gender piece, University Dean Ashley Thompson, when she started helping out with CUNY Reading Corps, one of the things she brought to the table was the NYC Men's Teach Initiative.
Oh, wow.
So that was like, I just feel like CUNY Reading Corps has had so many of these special moments and opportunities. I believe that was in the fall of 21.
Right.
So a year in, we had a partnership there and that has been incredible too. So that is about bringing more men into the teaching profession, but particularly men of color.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so we have CUNY with this incredible diversity.
Right. Yeah.
And I actually think I may have been right. I think the CUNY's at the school of ed level, I do believe it's in the high 70s for students of color.
Yeah.
And I know CUNY Reading Corps is around 76% of our tutors are students of color. Right. And then you add this element to it. And so it's really this incredible opportunity for those of us who really believe this in education to partner with an institute like this.
One of the things that I keep hearing from this conversation, and one that gets me really excited, is this idea of integration and seeing beyond the work. We've probably talked about integration at our prior episode, but really it's that it's not just about reading. It's not just about one small discipline, right? You're talking about increasing diversity and empowering a future and current teaching force. You're talking about bringing this integration of passion and purpose, of thinking institutionally across so many different types of layers that, I mean, it's, you're thinking beyond yourself and you're getting deeper. And I love that. And there's so much magic to it. And as I talk about this, there's more questions I want to ask. So I'm going to talk to my co-host a little bit, that we only have about 3 minutes with Dr. Milo. And so I think I want to jump into the leadership reflection questions. I'll choose one. You choose one.
No, please go.
First one is, I admire you so much. I admire your work. And I know there's so many educators around, you know, who I speak to, not even just in New York City, like across the United States, across the globe, that we just admire so much. And there's so much magic that I'm seeing in the work that you're doing. I would like to humanize you a little bit. So what I mean by that is, you came here, you're such a presence. And, you know, you talk about this, your journey as a leader, as an educator, as a researcher. I'd like to know, though, about a particular time that you experienced a lot of challenge or even failure, and how you were able to navigate that in your career.
Great question.
Sure. I hate to keep it all on CUNY Reading Corps, but it's a great example.
Right.
This was the hardest thing I've ever done in my career when we got this off the ground, and it had a lot of failures. Mm. It sounds now like it's this great, you know, thing that just kept growing and growing. There were so many starts and stops along the way. I mean, when you think about it, schools kept opening and closing. Mm-hmm. And every time that happened throughout the pandemic, the whole initiative was destabilized. It almost like fell apart, and then we had to rebuild it. Or we would, there would be then suddenly a vaccine mandate and the DOE was down thousands of teachers, right? So that destabilized us, because we were so reliant on the school coordinator to help us out, or anything along the way. At one point, there was a decision made at Central with the previous administration that we could only do this in after school. Mm-hmm. That destabilized us. So we had to move all these kiddos that we were tutoring during the school day into after school. Mm-hmm. And also, I was experienced constant failure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't really know. I think we just kept. And when I say we, I really mean the CUNY Reading Corps team, Andrew Fletcher over at the DOE. I think we just kept this idea of like the child who needs us the most is there waiting for a tutoring session.
Yeah.
Right.
Like when you think about that, you're like, well, we just have to keep going. Yeah. So every time there was a no, sometimes I'll laugh. I'll say we picked up the phone and we found someone who would say yes.
Yeah.
And so we had to keep a really flexible mindset too. Right. I think that's a big part of leadership, I guess, is that, you know, I couldn't just have it my way or the highway. It was like, all right, you're going to make us do this dance. And so we're going to stick with you all the way through until the initiative stabilizes.
So. Yeah. I think the conditions you just described are probably why more folks don't do research in schools, right?
Oh, 100%.
Because
absolutely,
you cannot control for the millions of variables that are like show up on a day-to-day basis. So.
Those are the ones just top of mind, too,
yeah,
right?
Exactly,
and if you
gave
me a pen, I could have listed 20.
Yeah, in 5 minutes, you probably could have listed 100.
Exactly.
So, thank you so much for sharing. Because I do think the idea of, you know, It's never just a linear progression forward, right?
Yeah.
Step forward, step back. Sometimes two steps back. We kind of reflect, regather. So I really appreciate you sharing that. One thing in my leadership practice that I spend a fair amount of time doing, one is I never feel like I'm doing enough. And you have just reinforced that today. I'm not doing enough.
I feel like I'm never doing enough either.
And so, I do think a lot of leaders bring that kind of mindset to the table. But I also love when I get to meet people and sort of reflect and show a little gratitude and appreciation for all the great skills in others. This idea of experiencing awe, you know, in a moment when you see someone doing something really incredible, like just taking a moment and saying, oh my gosh, like, wow. And then in sharing that appreciation and that work. And I have a lot of colleagues who I love and adore. I get to spend a little time like being in awe of the great things that you're doing. It inspires me. It moves me. It motivates me. It pushes me to kind of think about things in a little different way. To challenge myself, to set some of those really big audacious goals that like feel a little scary to even verbalize out loud. But I think those are some of the things that really drive us in such a good way. So if you could reflect maybe on one or two things that you, when you look out and you see some folks in your space doing some work, what are some traits or things that really kind of cause you to take a moment and say like, wow, like experience a little bit of awe or appreciation around in other leaders?
I've really been in awe of the individuals that came on to support this project because they came on at unique times when there was a very specific need. And they, I think they saw the need too coming into it, and they were experts in that. And it doesn't mean that you have to be the CEO or the director or whatever. But in fact, the now Dr. Erin Croak, who runs the day to day of this, she and, University Dean Thompson, they saw exactly what I needed, which is I'm not an HR specialist. I'm not a budgeting specialist or although I'm an academic, right? Yeah. And so I am in awe of people with that skill. I am truly, and I think sometimes they don't get enough of the limelight and all of those things, but they're the, they are the people that keep this growing and scaling. And the individuals, Max DeWord, Paula Jimenez, Josh Barocas, who came on, they were, those were grad students in my courses or an individual in my lab.
Wow.
And they, I remember them saying to me, do you think maybe you could use support with this? You know, and I'd be like, yes, I do. I do exactly need that. And they would step in and execute those skills, and it would give me space too to then do more. I think they really are so good at what they do, and that enables me to try to be better at what I need to do.
Yeah.
We all have our areas, like you said.
We do.
Of expertise and strengths.
Yeah.
And I think a team really gels when we give each other space to be the leader in what we're each best at.
Yeah. I completely agree. And I, you know, and I think you're absolutely right about the idea of the finance budget kind of operational side of things, right?
Yes.
You know, that, that is, I'm an educator. You know, I didn't, I have had to learn how to run a really large nonprofit. With about 400 employees, 1,000 families, you know, and running the finances for that. And it's, but I don't think we talk about how important that sort of fiscal responsibility and thinking about those things from a planning perspective, kind of, because if we don't get that right, we can't do the fun stuff.
That's right.
Like there's a foundational kind of piece there that people often forget about.
Exactly. I get to go and do school visits.
Yeah.
And I get to, you know, tweak the programs. I get to do all the contents specialty pieces. I get to now run the research and, and whatnot. And that's because the pieces you're talking about are taken care of. Like I was just on a school visit and it was like, oh, I can do this because the CUNY Reading Corps team is really solidly doing all of those things so that tutors are being paid and everything's accounted for and observations of the tutors are happening. That's like one of the most important things we could be doing.
So I always think about that too. And in leaders is that you're not doing it all by yourself.
You're not.
But there's a team of people with expertise and you're all helping when needed. And that speaks a lot to time, right? When leaders think about implementing a new program or disseminating a new program, you can't do it all by yourself because you physically don't have the time and energy to do that.
That's right.
So I love that.
Yeah, yeah. The program would still just be over and it would be great. It would be a great program just over at Brooklyn College. But by I think me also accepting help and these incredible people coming to me with their expertise that that were different than mine, this is how we've been able to grow.
We could do a whole podcast on accepting help.
Like,
a whole leadership discussion on just it, learning to accept help and knowing your strengths and working with a teammate. So,
definitely. Well, we do have to wrap up this podcast episode. Do you want any final words for Dr. Miles?
I just really appreciate everything that you're doing for the New York City kids, everything you're doing for pre-service teacher training, everything you're doing from a research perspective. You know, this work, I hope that folks listen to this. And maybe if there's somebody sitting out in Des Moines, Iowa, who's training pre-service teacher, who thinks to themselves, there might be a different way to do this.
Oh, please.
Maybe a more effective way to help get teachers ready for that, the experience they're going to face when they do get into a classroom. So thank you for your courage on that. Thank you for your vision. And thank you for your incredibly hard work to get there. So, such an exciting time right now.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. I have colleagues across the country that I'm about to email as soon as you leave to say, oh my gosh, you need to connect. But, but thank you so much, Dr. Miles, for being here. And thank you to all our readers who are leading in their schools, whether they're in their classroom or they're in their schools or maybe they're just families or
yes.
We have a lot of researchers that also listen to this. So I'm going to say this again. I'm trying to making leaders on readers a thing. It's not working. So we'll just say readers who lead who are joining this community. And we thank you so much for being in this community. And thank you for being here.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to share.
Thank you. And for all of you that are listening or you're watching, feel free to join the conversation about leading and reading on all of our social media pages, including Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. I think we have LinkedIn. At least I'm on LinkedIn. I like to share this. You're on social media.
I'm terrible. I keep trying and I keep failing.
Yeah, it's a failure.
Okay. Yes,
that's all right.
Social media presence is a failure.
Yeah. Again, that's not your time. Not in your time.
It's not my area of strength. Yeah. I'm going to get better at it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, on the official sign off, thank you, Jamie. Thank you, Dr. Miles. And until next time, readers.
Thank you.